You are tuned in to another edition of Americana Music Profiles, brought to you by Americana Rhythm Music Magazine and AmericanaMusicMagazine.com. I'm your host, Greg Tutwiler. Let's jump right in to the next exciting interview. By the time Steve Thomas had finished high school, he had won the Galax Fiddlers Convention as well as the Virginia State Mandolin Championship. He went on to help create the Lonesome River Band with friend Tim Austin. Steve is now fronting his own band, The Time Machine, with a new CD on the way, and he is my guest on this edition of Americana Music Profiles. Hi, Steve. Welcome to the podcast today.
Hey, glad to be here.
Good to get a chance to speak with you. You've been at this for a little while, haven't you?
Yeah, probably about 35 or plus years.
Yeah. I noticed in the press material you grew up in near Roanoke, Virginia. Is that right?
I did. I grew up my teen years going to a bunch of fiddle contests that were very popular around that year, around that area.
Galax, maybe one of them.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
It's big.
Yeah. I think I saw that you actually went to Shenandoah University as well. Is that right?
No, I never attended. There was some press in there. I was being offered a partial scholarship to go there, but I haven't read the edited press that you were sent, so I'm not exactly sure what you read. But I was attending college when I was offered a job by Del McCurry.
Okay.
Dixie Pals at the time, and being young and impulsive and thinking that I knew better, I dropped out of college and went to work with Del McCurry in 1982.
Where were you attending college? Were you at Shenandoah University?
No, I was at Virginia Western, taking some classes to prepare me to go there.
I see. Okay.
And just trying to save that money, and you know how that goes.
So sure. Yeah.
Doing the community college thing, and then I got a call from a guy named David Parmley, who was the lead singer with the Bluegrass Cardinals, who was a friend of mine at the time, telling me about Del McCurry, and of course I had some of his records and was a fan. And said he needed a fiddler, and so I auditioned, and the next thing you know, I'm traveling the world in a tour bus, which was pretty meager, 1954 GM bus, it was a very exciting time for me.
And how old were you at that time?
19.
Wow. So that's a lot for a 19-year-old, for sure.
Yeah, well, it was a dream, and, just jumped at the opportunity as it came by. So never really looked back. I mean, I didn't encourage my children to do that when we got to those years, but I was sort of on my own and impulsive, and, so here I am. That was my college, so to speak.
So how did music begin for you as a younger child?
When I was very young, mostly just around the holidays and things like that, my dad played music, and we would, gatherings with the family. I had an uncle that played and a cousin that played, and so it was mostly like that. And, then occasionally on a night, usually a weekend night, we would maybe visit with a neighbor that had a little guitar under his bed or something like that, and play some old hymns or old country songs, and I was sort of a unique situation for a guy of my age in the 70s, because we were very isolated and lived on a farm and no telephone, and
wow.
I can't remember having a record player or anything like that, so the music was all live.
Mm-hmm.
So in my early, when I say early, I mean from, preschool up to 9 years old, 10 years old during those years. And I want to say by the time I was eight or nine, we had gotten a record player. And it was funny, we had a fire in the house that burned out. And and some of the things that we received from people. One thing was an old RCA console record player and a bunch of show records, like Annie Get Your Gun.
Really?
Like
okay.
It seemed like we had a couple of Johnny Cash records, and maybe my sister got a Beatle record, and there was a few things kind of showing up. But still, most of my musical experience was from playing with local pickers around there.
Right.
Just in social settings, you know. And so that's kind of how it was early on. Kind of really unique to be growing up in the 70s and be that isolated, but that's sort of the way it was.
Right, yeah. So when did you take to a particular instrument? You played fiddle and mandolin, right?
Yeah, well, I started playing acoustic guitar.
Okay.
My dad taught me a few chords to be able to back him up on the fiddle. He was a fiddler.
Okay.
And so he taught me the basic bluegrass rhythm and a few bluegrass chords just to, you know, you had it as a guitar. If you have a G chord and a capo, you're good to go.
Right.
So that was my experience when I was young. And then my father passed. Most of my childhood, I'm going to say for about 7 years to 12 years, he was in a battle with cancer, and he lost that battle.
Mm-hmm.
And that was about, I want to say, within a couple of years of that, my mother had sold that farm and moved us closer into the city. And I was having a little more involvement with some other musicians. Around 15 or so, I met one of my best friends growing up was a guy named Ricky Riddle. He played mandolin for a while with a band called Santa Cruz with Wyatt Rice, and I think Genius Fisk was the lead singer in that band. So this would have been somewhere in the 90s, I think, that he played with those bands. But we were kids, and he, along with a guy named Jerry McMillan, who was the first bass player of the Lonesome River Band. These were my 15, 16-year-old, in that age, with, friends. And they turned me on to J.D. Crow and Boone Creek and some of the more modern things that were happening. And from then on, and I was totally submerged myself in that culture and that music.
And
that's when I switched, you know, it was in there probably about 15. I think I was playing a little fiddle before that. I entered a little contest when I was 15, and there was a little band called East Virginia Grass from the Roanoke area, and they hired me to play the fiddle, and I really couldn't play that much. I knew a song or two, but from then on, I switched from guitar to fiddle then from there on. And was always playing the mandolin a little bit. Because I played guitar, the right-hand thing was already there. So
right,
it was
yeah.
A no-brainer. And so I was playing. Well, I tell you, after I heard Boone Creek and I heard Ricky Skaggs playing mandolin and fiddle and everything, and I wanted to do that, you know.
Yeah, sure.
It was a very big influence on me.
And did I read where you actually won the Galax fiddle contest?
I did win Galax.
Yeah.
Galax in 1982.
Okay, yeah.
And it was, I mean, I can tell this now, I don't think they'll take the trophy away, but, I entered the contest and then left, I want to say, part of the contest was probably on a Thursday night, and I took off and drove to play a show with Del McCurry, and I don't think you were supposed to be playing in a professional band and still entering that contest. So I kept it on the down low. But, I think I was only making maybe $100 to play with Del McCurry. I don't think I made more in the fiddle contest.
Yeah.
that's just, one of those things where they have those little rules. So, like I said, I don't think they'll take that away from me now. But
right.
I kind of kept that on the down low,
And then it wasn't long after that you actually were instrumental in helping create the Lonesome River Band. Is that right?
Yeah, all this was happening that year. This was 1982. So I was playing probably 18 and 19 locally with Tim Austin, and we had the Lonesome River Band together.
Mm-hmm.
The original lineup was me playing the mandolin and fiddle and singing. and Tim Austin playing guitar and singing, and Rick Williams playing a five-string banjo, and this Jerry McMillan playing bass and singing most of the lead and tenor. Jerry's a great singer. But it was a great little band. I don't know how much material we had. I think we were mostly doing covers, Country Gentlemen. You know, Doyle Austin was real hot. Probably playing some of their songs. But, we were playing some festivals and this and that, but Rick Williams and myself, he was actually there before me. We were working with Del McCurry at the simultaneously because the Lonesome River Band was basically a just a local band.
Right.
And so we were using that to fill in dates, you know, for Rick and I to play around the Roanoke area. And we traveled some and worked around North Carolina and Virginia, West Virginia, played some, a few festivals. But I was, you know, obligated with Del to do those dates. So the Lonesome River Band was kind of a secondary thing. And Tim was Tim Austin was very serious about making it work, and you know, somewhere in there, he kind of pressed me that he wanted to have a full band, a full time band. So I think Rick and I probably both dropped out of that band that year, later in that year, and he hired Jeff Nitkus to play the mandolin. And I think Randy Driscoll, and that was the first band that recorded for Rebel Records. For the
right,
Lonesome
okay.
River Band.
So where did it go for you from there? Because you've gotten to play with a lot of different folks and a lot of different different styles of bluegrass and country throughout your years.
Yeah, so, you know, I was dating who was still my wife, you know, Janet. We were dating, and we were pretty serious about starting a family. And, you know, that had a big play in how we made decisions as far as what I did, because that kind of kept me from starting a band, having a family. I sort of made that. So I was basically moved myself into a utilitarian musician.
Right, okay.
A side man, you know, I worked, I played that year with Del McCurry, and then Janet and I got married the next year, went to Nashville and played with Jim and Jeffy and the Virginia Boys on the Grand Ole Opry, which was pretty secure work at the time. They were working over 100 days a year on the road, plus the Grand Ole Opry. They were probably one of the hottest acts in the country at the time. I mean, all of the Opry acts in the early 80s were you know, the Osmond Brothers in Monroe and Jim and Jesse were very sought after and worked a lot. Those were very stable positions for a side man. So I was there for about a year. Anyway, excuse me. I remember getting on, Janet and I got married July 2nd in 1983, and we went on a little honeymoon, which was following Jim and Jesse's bus to bluegrass festivals, and not very romantic, but I left her in Northern Virginia, and she drove down to Nashville and took off from there somewhere up around D.C. to the West Coast for a 30-day tour with Jim and Jesse. We were 28 or 30 dates, and she was alone by herself in Nashville for the first month in an apartment. It's like maybe 20 years old, I think. And when I got back, she was just a little bit, you know, just it was a little much to her. And so we decided maybe that just to get our feet solid in our marriage and on the ground and all that, we moved back to Virginia for, I want to say, in October or November of that year. And I played then for the next 18 months with the Lost and Found and did a record with them called The Spin Song of Shine on Rebel Records. And that lineup was the first record with Steve Wilson playing guitar and singing lead. And we lived up there. And then somewhere in early 85, I was offered a job with the White and Jerry Douglas to come to Nashville, play fiddle in that band.
Okay.
And they were real popular, and I thought that was it was one of those jobs every fiddle player in the country at that time that wanted to get to Nashville would love to have that gig. So
right.
I had to go. You know, I went back and did that. Stayed with them for almost 5 years. Then toured a couple of years with the Osmond Brothers into the 80s. And, you know, kids were getting a little older. We were wanting a little nicer place. And I decided at that point, somewhere 89, 90, there's some way to leave bluegrass and go into the country deal. There was a lot of, you know, that was the 90s was the beginning of a real big time for country music. That was
right.
When Vince was hitting Clint Black and that whole era of country music. Then through the 90s, I went to work with Aaron Tippett,
mm-hmm.
and played on his second album and produced his first number one record, There Ain't Nothing Wrong With The Radio, and I played fiddle on that record.
Wow, cool.
And, you know, just doing the thing, but still not really doing what I wanted to. I mean, enjoying being part of the music community in Nashville for sure. And, you know, I went on to work then with Brooks and Dunn. I worked 6 years with Barbara Mandrell, who was still pretty hot
mm-hmm.
in the mid-90s. She was a pretty big act, and, you know, that allowed a lot of travel and bigger shows and kind of the country lifestyle thing, you know. But I still was a little bit, it was frustrating, you know. I was seeing all the success of the Lonesome River Band and the other guys that I started with, and I was always kind of itching to do that. Same time doing what I felt like I needed to for the family type thing, you know.
Sure.
So what? I was finding it hard to get. It's funny when you get into that, and then you get in that money, then it's really hard to start a business.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Step off that.
So what brought you back to bluegrass? When did that start for you?
Well, I want to say somewhere around 2000, early 2000s. I'd have to look now and see. Kind of a little bit of a blur, but I was touring at the end of all that. Was touring with John Michael Montgomery.
Mm-hmm.
And Ronnie Bowman was in Nashville and just starting to have some success as a songwriter, and had left the Lonesome River Band and was doing this thing. I did an album with him. It's Getting Better All The Time album.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever the year
yeah.
that came out was during those years. And we recorded that at my studio. And I toured with him for a couple of years there, and of course still freelance, did some country stuff, but mostly playing with him, and he kind of encouraged me back into it. But at that point, you know, I was a little bit on the road, off the road sort of thing. I was mostly just doing freelance studio work and producing some albums, and got into producing, and was doing a little bit of bluegrass with like the Crow Brothers. I was producing their albums
mm-hmm.
and recording their albums when they had been out of it for a while. We went back a long way, so that was a lot of fun for me. Produced Luke McKnight, Jesse's grandson, producing bluegrass for him. Some other lesser known acts, but I want to say from there on up until around 2013, I think somewhere in there, I got hooked up with Mark Newton, and we were just playing around town one night, and he said that might have even been his wife said to me, "Hey, are you doing anything?" I said, "Well, I'm actually just working in town." And she said, "Would you be interested in doing a project with Mark?" And she hooked me and Mark up, and we did a project for Pinecastle and produced them. Top 10 number one records in the Bluegrass Today chart.
Wow, cool.
Played quite a few festivals with that. And, I did that somewhere around 2014 or 15. Mark had some serious health issues pop up, and it kind of slowed him down. And so I just kind of went back to doing what I was doing until here this last Christmas, Lonnie Lasker from Pine Castle Records called to see how I was doing, wished me a Merry Christmas. And as we were talking, she said, "Oh, when are you going to do another record for me?"
Mm.
And I thought, because I hadn't really been thinking about it. But, you know, there's a thing with a musician when you write and sing and play, you're always preparing, and you're never really getting it out there, you know. So I had all this material laying around, stuff that I really wanted to do. I want to say probably 20 years I've been kind of itching or working on my own thing. You know, the whatever we are, it's a culmination of everything we've done and worked with, all these influences.
Right.
And, you know, I thought, you know, the kids are gone. Janet and I are in pretty good shape. And I didn't get to do it when I was young, but this is a great market for people that just want to do art. They're not really worried about whether you're the young, youngest, hottest looking thing out there. You know, they're happy to just listen to the music. And you know, I got thinking about that. It wasn't a week or two, and I said, okay. And I don't know to this day. I never have asked Lonnie, but he might have been just saying that in conversation. But it was like, okay, I'm taking you up on it.
Yeah, that's funny. So the new band, Steve Thomas and the Time Machine, one record out? Are you working on a new one, or are you still working on the first one?
I was just doing the liners when you called today. We we've probably got, you know, enough stuff in the can. I think all together we cut about 16 songs, and we're going to put 12 on the record. So we're working on the next one right now. You know, we want to, once I kind of turned it on, yeah, I was going to do this. We just got really working as hard as we could. We got busy. So I'm wanting to have another record out. This one's not even out yet, but I'm hoping maybe this one will be out for 8 or 9, 10 months and already have the next one in the pipeline.
So the one that you're working on now, is that number two? Do you already have one out, or is this the first one?
No, it's the first one.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I was just doing the liners for this one.
Yeah.
Hopefully, when I get all the stuff in, I'm hoping that we'll have the hard copy in March.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
That's what we're shooting for. That'll give us, you know, a couple of months before it's released to do some, you know, promotional stuff.
Do you have a name for it yet?
I think it's going to be Steve Thomas and the Time Machine All of These Years.
Okay. Cool.
And All of These Years is a song that I got from a band called the Steelwoods. They're a southern rock band.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw it in the copy a few weeks ago. And they, I kept this song. I had Del McCurry was gracious enough to come in and sing tenor on this record. And it's sort of a blues song. And I played it for those guys at the Opry, and they were just stunned. You know, it kind of made me feel good. They're like, that's what we know is bluegrass.
That's awesome.
I think it's going to be my next single, and we're going to get that out before the record.
Okay.
We've had one single off of this record, Down in the Wildwood. And it went to number 5.
Yeah, yeah.
The bluegrass charts.
Yeah. That one was doing well on Sirius. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, all my friends are sending me pictures of it, you know.
That's good.
I take a picture of the title. Hey, you're getting played.
Yeah.
You know, we're getting out there making a little noise.
So if people want to follow you, keep in touch, where's the best way? What's your website? What's the best way to track the record?
Time Machine. Yeah. Steve Thomas and Time Machine on Facebook, and then, SteveThomasMusic.net, my webpage. And between those two things, you should be able to kind of keep up with what I'm doing.
Awesome. Good. Well, thank you, Steve. It was neat hearing your story and all that you've done, and we certainly wish you well with this new chapter.
Hey, thank you so much. Thank you for giving me a little time to talk to your family.
Thanks again for tuning in to this episode of Americana Music Profiles. Find us on iTunes at Americana Music Profiles and on the internet at AmericanaRhythm.com.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Frunino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.